A legislator, both bold and courageous, and also prepared to risk their role, their position, their elected position, will step in and put an end to the Melbourne-based Australian Grand Prix. Some would say that in the present environment, such a move would be foolish, and it probably would be. But if we are to ever meet our 2050 goal, which is fanciful and plain silly, that legislated goal is net zero by 2050, then events such as the Grand Prix simply have to go. It's carbon rich in every sense. I don't care whether it's electric cars or whatever, it's still carbon rich. It has to go. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. A story from the Melbourne Age by Chip Legrand gives us the background to the Australian Grand Prix. The headline for his story is, "The Australian Grand Prix is here to stay, but at what cost?" The subheadline says, "Formula One is contracted to remain in Melbourne for another 14 years, extending to 4 decades the city's love-hate relationship with its rumbling, high-octane race weekend. The cost concentrates on the economic cost of the Grand Prix. It says nothing about the carbon cost, what the race weekend will contribute to Australia's carbon dioxide emissions. Not only are they fossil-burning cars, tons and tons of equipment are brought by plane from overseas, and thousands upon thousands of supporters, or fans as you may call them, travel from all around the world for what is one of a series of huge events." Legrand's story, for which there'll be a link in the show notes, tells us about Peter Goad, the long-serving president of Save Albert Park, which has protested the location of the race since Michael Schumacher completed his first hot lap there in 1996. Goad is 99 years old. He turns 100 in October. And despite his remarkable longevity, he has resigned, never witnessing the day when the GP leaves town for good. "It would be nice to think I would survive to see the thing booted out of the park, but it's unlikely to happen," he says from his Middle Park home. Goad, as far as I'm aware, was protesting how the race affected the amenity of his Middle Park home. "I'm protesting about how the race affects Australia's carbon dioxide emissions. It's massive, it's carbon intense, and it just shouldn't be there. This high-octane, noisy, carbon-rich weekend defies the Victorian government's aims at reducing its carbon dioxide emissions. The event is simply contrary to the state's aims." Now next we have a story from Nick O'Malley in the Melbourne Age. It has the headline, "Scientists struggle to explain really weird spike in world temperatures." The story begins. It was meant to be a celebration. A group that included some of the world's leading climate scientists gathered earlier this month at a home in the German city of Potsdam for a colleague's birthday dinner. Among them was the Australian Bill Hare, who leads the climate think tank Climate Analytics, and he has served as lead author on key United Nations climate reports. He recalls it, rather than celebratory, the mood that night was at times grim. Conversation shifted between two topics. One was unprecedented, horrifying heat the world had experienced over the past year. The second was a fierce debate that had broken out between two climate experts around the world about what temperatures might mean and what has driven them so high, so fast. Let's listen now to the audio from that story.
Scientists struggle to explain really weird spike in world temperatures. It was meant to be a celebration. A group that included some of the world's leading climate scientists gathered earlier this month at a home in the German city of Potsdam for a colleague's birthday dinner. Among them was the Australian Bill Hare, who leads the climate think tank Climate Analytics and has served as a lead author on key United Nations climate reports. As he recalls it, rather than celebratory, the mood that night was at times grim. Conversation shifted between two topics. One was the unprecedented, horrifying heat the world has experienced over the past year. The second was the fierce debate that has broken out between climate experts around the world about what the temperatures might mean, and what has driven them so high, so fast. In one camp is Professor James Hansen, famous as the NASA scientist who in 1988 warned the United States Congress that global warming was not just a real phenomenon, but one that was already observably changing our climate. He now believes that warming is accelerating faster than scientists had anticipated, that the climate models relied upon by world governments have a built-in flaw that is underestimating warming, and that the Paris Accord's ambition of holding warming to 1.5 degrees has already failed. The 1.5 degree limit is deader than a doornail, Hansen, now a director at the Earth Institute at Columbia University, told reporters in November last year. In the next several months, we're going to go well above 1.5°C on a 12-month average. For the rest of this decade, the average is going to be at least 1.5. A leading light in the other camp is the famous climatologist Dr. Michael Mann, director of the Center for Science, Sustainability and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania. He believes that the extreme temperatures of the past year fall within the models, see above, though at the extreme high end of them, and that declarations that they are broken and that we have already left the 1.5 target in our wake is dangerous. There has been a tendency to exaggerate the science in favor of doomist narratives, he told this masthead this week. That helps nobody, except the fossil fuel industry, of course. For billions of people on Earth, the stakes of the debate could not be higher, and at its heart is what Hansen calls our Faustian bargain with the fossil fuels. Pollution that both heats and cools. What he means is that many of the industrial processes that release warming gases like methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere also release sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide. These gases, while dangerous, also have a short-term cooling effect because they reflect some heat back into space. As a result, says Hansen, some of our pollution is masking the heat we have already locked into the system, and as we strip out the pollution, the mask is being lifted and warming is accelerating. Hansen, and some others, believe that climate models used by scientists around the world, and the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, have failed to adequately take the impact of aerosol masking into consideration. This might explain the extreme temperatures of the past 12 months, and suggests climate change will hit harder and faster than governments are being told. So how hot has it been? Last month, the European Union's Earth Observation Programme, known as Copernicus, announced that, according to its data, the world had just gone through its first 12-month period with the world's average temperature at 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial average, which is in line with Hansen's grim warning in November. Dr. Zeke Hausfather, a climatologist with the University of California, Berkeley, says it is hard to capture the extraordinary heat of the previous year by looking at averages. Instead, he looks at the awful peaks, noting extremes recorded in the Arctic and Antarctic, parts of Asia and the Americas. For periods of the northern summer, the waters off parts of Florida reached an unimaginable 38 degrees, beating a previous world record water surface temperature in Kuwait Bay in 2020. That is a hot tub temperature, he says. Also lending weight to Hansen's analysis have been the extreme temperatures recorded as recently as this week. Maximiliano Herrera, a climatologist and weather historian who monitors extreme weather events, has a social media feed that is now a litany of shattered records. South Africa is living a madness. Months with thousands of records destroyed every day, he wrote on Wednesday. Today 45.1°C at Wielsdrif, latest 45°C in southern Africa history. Days before he noted a temperature recorded in Turkmenistan of 35 degrees, 10 degrees above the previous record. Latin America is boiling from Mexico to Argentina, he wrote a day earlier. Guyana 37.4 at Lethem, hottest March day in Guyana history set twice in few days. The models. Asked if he believes Hansen is right, Hare pauses carefully. You know, I think it's a dangerous thing to challenge Jim Hansen. Right. So one needs to be look very carefully at what is arguing. But Hare says people who have looked carefully at what Hansen is arguing, like those at that grim dinner party, have come to the conclusion that the UN's synthesis of climate models does adequately take in the aerosol effect. He explains that the UN's synthesis of climate models takes into account the full range of available climate modeling, with hundreds of scenarios from individual models. These models have been carefully tested by backcasting, that is, running observed climate data from previous decades through them to see that they are accurate. Those that are found to be too hot, compared with actual weather observations, are given reduced weight in future projections. Hausfather is cautious about dismissing Hansen's position, too. All of 2023 was exceptionally warm, but it was really weird in the last 4 months, and that is why a lot of climate scientists are a little freaked out, he says. Housefather explains that since we started pumping warming gases into the atmosphere during the Industrial Revolution, the world has warmed by about 1.3 degrees. A strong El Niño can force up the average temperature by about 0.2 degrees in addition to this, at and after its peak. These two drivers would explain why the average global temperature is being recorded at about 1.5 degrees now, as the current El Niño ebbs, but it does not explain the extreme temperatures recorded between August and November. He makes another point, too. Over recent decades, the world has been warming by about 0.2 degrees a decade. So when we have an El Niño, we catch a glimpse of our future, of the temperatures we can expect to live through in a decade. That's what has made the past year so horrific to some climate observers. Like Mann and Hare, though, he does not believe the lack of clear explanation for the savage heat of the past year necessarily means that Hansen is right in arguing that models are broken and the 1.5 degree target lost. Under the terms of the Paris Accord, the 1.5 degree target is not considered broken unless average temperatures remain above it for years. The agreement takes into account the possibility that even if the world manages to reduce emissions adequately, it might experience temperatures above that mark for years before they stabilize and begin to fall later in the century. All agree that, though this recent heat is alarming, and that it has challenged the boundaries of the UN's most recent modeling, the model still stands. And they agree that temperature increase is accelerating. And all agree that even if Hansen's most dire predictions do not prove to be correct, there is little joy in the current data. As I like to say, the truth is bad enough, says Mann. There's no reason to exaggerate to make the case for urgent action.
Yes, and next we have an opinion piece from the Melbourne Age, and it's by Ross Gittins. The headline for his story is, "I'll be dead before the worst of it. But I'm fearful for those who won't. Rather than you endure me reading out the first few paragraphs, I'll go straight to the audio.
I'll be dead before the worst of it, but I'm fearful for those who won't. I keep reading psychologists warning that talking about how terrible climate change will be is counterproductive. Rather than causing the deniers to see the error of their ways, it just makes them close their minds to further argument. So this column isn't for them. Rather, it's to speak to the rest of us, those who don't try to tell the scientists they've got it all wrong, to review the latest evidence that climate change is already upon us, what sane person could not have realized it, and getting worse as each year flashes by our eyes. I fear for my 5 grandkids' future, as I may have mentioned before, but, to tell the truth, I'm glad I'll be dead and gone before it reaches its worst. What we must do, like all those who voted teal at the last election, is to press both major parties to speed up our efforts and make Australia a leader rather than a laggard in the global push to limit how bad it gets. Professor Albert van Dijk of the Australian National University, an expert on precipitation, is part of an international team of researchers who've issued a report, The Global Water Monitor, using data from thousands of ground stations and satellites to document the effect of last year's record heat on the world's water cycle. We found global warming is profoundly changing the water cycle, he says. As a result, we are seeing more rapid and severe droughts, as well as more severe storms and flood events. Van Dijk says the most obvious sign of the climate crisis is the unprecedented heat waves that swept the globe in 2023. Some 77 countries experienced their highest average annual temperature in at least 45 years. This gave us a glimpse of what a typical year with 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming may look like, he says. Warming consistently more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels is expected to have extreme and irreversible impacts on the Earth's system. The high temperatures were often accompanied by very low air humidity. The relative air humidity of the global land surface was the second driest on record in 2023. Rapid drying of farms and forests caused crops to fail and forests to burn. Lack of rain and soaring temperatures intensified multi-year droughts in vulnerable regions such as South America, the Horn of Africa, and the Mediterranean. This continuing trend towards drier conditions is threatening agriculture, biodiversity, and overall water security. Get this, the world's forests have been soaking up a lot of our fossil fuel emissions. That's because plant photosynthesis absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Large disturbances like fire and drought reduce or even reverse that function. Rising sea surface and air temperatures have been intensifying the strength and rainfall intensity of monsoons, cyclones and other storm systems, Van Dyke adds. We saw this when Cyclone Jasper battered northern Queensland and severe storms formed in southeast Queensland, leaving a trail of destruction. The cyclone moved much slower than expected, causing torrential rains and widespread flooding. Enough of that. Australia's Climate Council, a community-funded organisation created by former members of the Climate Commission after it was abolished by the Abbott government in 2013, has created a heat map using thousands of data points from the CSIRO and help from the Bureau of Meteorology. If we assume, perhaps optimistically, that all countries meet their present UN commitments to reduce emissions, the heat map predicts that Western Sydney will swelter through twice as many days above 35 degrees and 3 weeks above 35 degrees every summer. Temperatures will be worsened by the urban heat island effect, as materials such as asphalt and concrete amplify heat by as much as 10 degrees during extreme heat. Melbourne, too, faces double the number of days above 35 degrees by 2050. Will it take that long for the Australian Open to be moved? Which brings us to last month, when 6 transmission line towers in Victoria were destroyed by extreme wind gusts from thunderstorms, leading to about 500,000 people losing power. The intense winds knocked trees onto local power lines or toppled the poles. Some people went without electricity for more than a week. A month earlier, severe thunderstorms and wind took out 5 transmission towers in Western Australia and caused widespread outages. In January 2020, storms caused the collapse of 6 transmission towers in Victoria. And, of course, in 2016, all of South Australia lost power for several hours after extreme winds damaged many transmission towers. Recent research by Dr. Andrew Dowdy and Andrew Brown, of the University of Melbourne, suggests that climate change is likely to cause more favourable conditions for thunderstorms with damaging winds, particularly in inland regions. But more research is needed to confirm this. Van Dyke gets the last word. Overall, 2023 provided a stark reminder of the consequences of our continued reliance on fossil fuels and the urgent need but apparent inability of humanity to act decisively to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Next, we have a story from the Washington Post and is by Erin Blakemore. It has the headline, Climate Change Threatens Snow Cover at Ski Destinations Worldwide. The story begins. 1 in 8 ski destinations will lose all the natural ski cover because of climate change by the end of the century, an analysis published this month in the journal PLOS ONE suggests. The chilling prediction points to falling snow cover in 7 major mountainous ski regions worldwide, with potential effects for local economies, vulnerable species, and winter sports lovers alike. Researchers paired geographic data about current ski locations and current snow cover days with climate models that predict what would happen in a variety of emissions scenarios. They looked at 7 mountain regions worldwide: the European Alps, Andes Mountains, Appalachian Mountains, Australian Alps, Japanese Alps, Southern Alps, in New Zealand, and Rocky Mountains. Overall, they found that annual snow days will significantly decrease worldwide with climate change under all 3 emission scenarios. The Southern Hemisphere will be hit hardest, they predict, with 78% of ski areas in the Australian Alps losing more than half of their average snow days per year by 2100. Next, we have a story from The Guardian. It's by Tasman Rose, Katie McLeod, and Tory Shepherd. It has the headline, Peter Dutton in standoff with state Liberal leaders over Federal Coalition's nuclear plan. The story begins. The Federal Coalition faces a battle with the states on its proposal for nuclear power stations on the sites of decommissioned coal power plants, with state premiers and opposition leaders alike largely against Peter Dutton's proposal. Labor governments and coalition oppositions in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia are either outright opposed to the plan or have failed to endorse it. Most of those states have their own bans on nuclear that would need to be lifted in addition to the federal ban if Dutton's plan were to progress. Despite this, the federal opposition leader has repeatedly called for nuclear to be considered as part of the future energy mix for Australia. And here we have another story from The Guardian, and this one's by Dana Knorr. It has the headline, World's largest oil companies way off track on emissions goals, report finds. The story begins. In recent years, virtually all of the world's largest oil companies have made splashy climate pledges. But when it comes to actually slashing emissions, those firms are way off track, a new report has found. The analysis from the think tank Carbon Tracker assessed the production and transition plans of 20 of the world's largest oil and gas companies. None align with the central goal of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement to keep global warming under 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, the report found. Next we have a story from Inside Climate News, and the story is by Nicholas Kuznets. Companies are poised to inject millions of tons of carbon underground. Will it stay put? The story begins. After more than a century of pulling carbon from underground, a rush is underway to pump it back down. Companies have applied for scores of permits across the country to inject carbon dioxide deep into the earth. Several projects have already been approved. With industry planning to inject tens of millions of tons annually, a looming question is whether the climate warming gas will stay underground. The most likely points of failure, experts say, could come from the millions of abandoned oil and gas wells that perforate the nation, often in the same areas targeted for storing carbon dioxide underground. A new report underscores the risk those wells pose in Louisiana, home to more proposed carbon storage projects than any other state. Come on, join me now as we switch to the Rolling Stone magazine. And the headline for the story is Blocking Burning Man and Vandalizing Van Gogh. Climate activists are done playing nice. The story is by Cassidy Rosenblum. It begins. The morning of the blockade, Emily Collins, co-founder of the climate group Rave Revolution, suits up in a pair of camo pants and combat boots, unaware of the conflict that lies ahead. In the garage, her fellow co-founder, Tommy D'Anconu, puts the finishing touches on his masterpiece, a human-sized Planet Earth sign made out of wood, with the day's objective emblazoned in white paint. Burners of the world unite. Nature loves courage, Dienko repeats to himself like he does every morning, quoting American ethnobotanist and mystic Terence McKenna. You make the commitment, and nature will respond to that commitment by removing impossible obstacles. Come on, come on, come on. Let's go back to Inside Climate News, where we have a headline, In Deep Red, Utah. Climate concerns are now motivating candidates. The story begins. Driving on Interstate 215 south of Salt Lake City in late January, I couldn't help but notice the bumper stickers on the pickup truck in front of me. One featured a rattlesnake and the classic motto, Don't Tread on Me, which states the Revolutionary War, but has been co-opted by many right-wing ideologues. And the other featured a map of a shrinking lake and the words, Keep the Salt Lake Great, the motto of local environment group focusing on protecting Utah's rivers and ecosystems. These dual views perfectly capture the ethos of Utah, a deep red state whose natural beauty has been threatened by more intense heat waves and extreme drought. A proud coal and oil-producing state, it's led by conservative lawmakers, and recent national surveys show it's one of the most Republican states in the country. Back in 2010, the Utah legislature even passed a resolution that essentially wrote climate change denial into state policy by urging the EPA to cease its carbon dioxide reduction policies, programs and regulations until climate data and global warming science is substantiated. But since then, Utah has been impacted by climate change more than most states. Over the last 50 years, temperatures in the states have risen at least twice the global average and has faced worsening drought, wildfires, flash floods, and extreme heat waves. The impact has been devastating on the health and well-being of residents, with decreasing productivity on farms and higher rates of respiratory disease and asthma, along with heat-related diseases. Here we are back with the Washington Post in a story by Scott Dance and Simon Ducroquet. The headline for the story is, These lakes are usually still frozen over. See how they look now. The story begins. The lakes from Minnesota to Maine are usually still frozen over at this time of the year, as signs of spring slowly emerge across the country's northern tier. Instead, the ice is breaking up or is already gone on many lakes, with more than a century of records, so-called ice out, when waters become navigable for boats again, is happening earlier than ever witnessed. It's a vivid sign that winters are warming faster than any other season across what is usually the frigid north. Declining snowfall and ice cover serve as both symptom and driver of that trend, in a feedback loop that is having stark effects in communities that thrive on harsh winters. "It's a little bit unsettling," said Chris O'Brien, a Wisconsin native who now serves as a marketing coordinator at an environmental non-profit in the Twin Cities. Yes, now we have a story from Futurity. It's been posted by Robert Sanders. It has the headline, "Heat Index, How Hot It Feels, Is Rising Faster Than Temperature." A new study concludes that the heat index, essentially how hot it really feels, has increased much faster in Texas than has the measured temperature, about three times faster. What that means is on some extreme days, what the temperature feels like is between 8 and 11 Fahrenheit hotter than it would be without climate change. That's 5 to 6 degrees Celsius. The study, using Texas data from June, July and August of 2023, highlights a problem with communicating the dangers of rising temperatures to the public. The temperature alone does not accurately reflect if the heat stress people feel. Even the heat index itself, which takes into account the relative humidity and thus the capacity to cool off by sweating, gives a conservative estimate of heat stress, according to a study by author David Romps, a professor of Earth and Planetary Science at the University of California, Berkeley. And finally for this episode, we'll go to a story from The Conversation, written by Gemma Ware, who is the editor and co-host of The Conversation Weekly podcast. The headline of the story is "Climate Quitting: The People Leaving Their Fossil Fuel Jobs Because of Climate Change." The story begins, "As the climate crisis gets ever more severe, the fossil fuel industry is struggling to recruit new talent. And now a number of existing employees are deciding to leave their jobs, some quietly, some very publicly, because of concerns over climate change. In this episode of the Conversation Weekly podcast, we speak to a researcher about this phenomenon of climate quitting. Here's the intro to that episode of the Conversation Weekly.
On a Friday afternoon, traveling home, I would feel physically uncomfortable. And I was wondering, like, why am I feeling physically uncomfortable? I had a good week. I've done good work.
Most of us have probably had an experience of working in a job we felt was wrong for us. But could you work at a job you felt was actually wrong?
And then you realize that, you know, you may have done good work, but the goal that you're working towards is evil in a way. It does not align with your moral compass.
Today we're exploring a phenomenon called climate quitting, which is when people leave their jobs because they don't align with their values around climate change. I'm Gemma Ware and this is The Conversation Weekly, the world explained by experts.
You'll find the link for that story and that podcast episode in the show notes. Yes, I could go on forever because my screen is alive with stories about the climate crisis, but I won't. So thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, I urge you to share it with your friends, put it on your networks, let people know what's happening with the climate crisis. Also, I'd love to hear from you, and you can contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so should you want to say something about the climate crisis, send me an email, let me know, and we can organise to contact you. If you're here in Australia, I can do it over the phone. If you're not, if you're overseas, we can do it via Zoom. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now please stay safe and take care.